How are you today, Quinn?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Good.
Did you have a good week?
Yes, I did. This when you had us look into Stoic, which I've never heard of, and then I look into it and read it, it leads you to one thing, to another thing, to another thing. It's just like I like, oh, order this book, order it's fascinating. Oh my God. And then this like meditation of this Marcus Aurelius, which is like, whoa, what is this? It's just like more things you realize you don't know.
We're going to discuss Stoicism today and briefly read some sections from the Enchiridion, written by Epictetus, who was one of the greatest Stoic philosophers. And as I mentioned last week, this is something that was introduced to me by my teacher as a Western parallel to the development of Buddhist thought in the East. It's become incredibly popular in our time, and there have been many, many, many versions of the Enchiridion published under different names. One of the most popular versions was called A Manual for Living, which is actually a translation of Enchiridion, which is a manual, a daily manual. We're going to begin and hope that we can answer some of the following questions by the end of our talk. What are the key points of the chapters that we will read? And what relationship do you see between Stoicism and what we've gone so far in the Buddhist Dharma? I mentioned to you that I ask my students to read Epictetus as preparation for beginning studies with me in Buddhist studies, always before I even ask them to read any Buddhist material. Why do I do that? These are all thoughts for you to consider. And various other questions that we may arise. So before we go into the Enchiridion itself, did everybody have a chance to go on to Wikipedia and familiarize themselves a little bit with Stoic philosophy, history, origins?
A little bit.
Yeah. Good. So let's touch on some major points here. It was originally founded in the 3rd century before the Common Era. So in fact, it's not so much after the Buddha's time, about 200 years. And the founding of Stoicism was being credited to Zeno of Citium, but he actually traces his lineage back to Socrates via his absorption of some philosophy of a group of people called the Cynics. And the founder of the Cynics, Antisthenes. Zeno of Citium is usually cited as the founder of the Stoics, but he traces his lineage back to Socrates via the Cynics. The Cynics were another group of philosophers. A very important point that we should start from the very beginning, actually, to mention, because I'm such a stickler for vocabulary, is to understand that the names of these philosophical schools are not necessarily directly correlated with the definitions these words have today. So, for example, when we say a Cynic, although it comes somehow connection to the Cynics, it is not the same thing as what the Cynics taught. So the Cynics did not teach cynicism. Understood? The same thing when we teach the modern understanding of the word Stoic or Stoicism, someone's very Stoic. Although there is a connection to the Stoics, it is not exactly what the Stoics taught. And we see here that by the fact that Zeno of Citium is credited with taking his inspiration from the Cynics, and Antisthenes, who was the founder of the Cynics, credited himself as being a student of Socrates, we see here the importance that philosophical lineage had in ancient Greek times. And what do we see? Does anybody notice something right away? A parallel with what we've been studying? We talked a little bit over the last classes about the lineage in the Buddhist philosophy and the Buddhist schools. Here we see a very similar parallel between a traditional school that credits a lineage to someone before him. And that gives credit to the philosopher. So let's talk a little bit about some of the principles of Stoicism. And I want, when I go over these principles, I'd like you to think about what you've been studying so far from the completely other side of the world and see how similar or how different it is, but how they address similar issues in life. One of the first principles, accepting the moment as it presents itself, not allowing oneself to be swayed by sensual desires, by fear, by aversion, or by wanting something, and using one's mind to understand the world and what one's role is in nature. And by working together with nature, we learn how to treat others fairly and justly. Very important principle. A second principle. This is a translation of how it's said in Greek, and then I'm going to elucidate a little bit on that. The direct translation from Greek is, virtue is the only good. And for human beings, what that means is that everything external, such as health, wealth, and pleasure, are not necessarily good or bad in themselves, but have only a value in the perspective and the context with which they arise. Perhaps that was a little bit confusing. Let's try to clarify that. By virtue, what they meant in ancient Greek philosophy was the ability to be in harmony with nature, to have one's entire being, especially one's heart and one's mind and one's actions, in harmony with the nature and the world around them, at least in Stoic philosophy we're speaking now. Not speaking for all Greeks, speaking for Stoic philosophy. Therefore, the essentiality of virtue is the only thing that could be called good. Do we understand that connection? Because that's the one thing that could not vary. Everything else, whatever we experience outside, the physical things, the pleasurable, the unpleasurable, the time, how we live, our physical condition, were considered contextual and could not be judged as either good or bad. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Good is when we are in harmony with nature. That is virtue. And by nature, they mean more than just the physical nature outside. They mean the very inner nature of our hearts and our minds in harmony with a flow that I've referred to in the past some classes as a universal ethic. Do you remember that term? A universal ethic. An ethical function, a way the universe works. And that is the good. Being in harmony with that. Then what we experience, it depends on how we respond to that and how it becomes an experience for us to practice virtue. Clear? Questions, thoughts, comments? Nope. Okay. Getting to the question of virtue. And this is where I want you to look at the first sheet, DE, that I sent you. You'll see an interesting thing. You see the Chinese character? Now, virtue as moral excellence, and very similar to what the Stoics referred to in virtue, and is expressed by Epictetus, is also strongly emphasized in Chinese philosophies of Taoism and Confucianism, perhaps a slightly different slant. But I would encourage you to look up in Wikipedia the word de. They have a whole page on it. But I want to explain to you, this is the character of de. Can everybody see that? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, everybody see this. Make sure. We see the three lines on the left side, two diagonal lines and one vertical line, is a radical. In Chinese characters, they're made up of different radicals, different aspects of the word. One, a radical is actually one, but then there's other parts that refer to something else. This radical means to go or to move. Xing. Two lines and the one vertical. Then the top character on the right-hand side, which is a cross above a box that has two divisions and the horizontal line, means zhi, which means straight. And the bottom character on the right with the three dashes and the hook means heart. So in this way, when they say the word virtue in the Chinese language, de, it means going straight to or from the heart. And this is a very important concept, again, both in Confucianism and in Taoism, because without de, no spiritual attainment, no happiness, no well-being can be truly obtained. Everything else is just ephemeral. And I'm showing this to you and sharing this to you because it's very similar in a direct parallel to what the Stoics said, without virtue, which is the only good, life can never be happy, can never be balanced, can never be lived properly. So again, we see a very interesting parallel at very similar times between very different cultures. So far, so good? Any questions? Great. Another comment. This is a quote from Epictetus himself. Philosophy does not promise to secure anything external for man. Otherwise, it would be admitting something that lies beyond its proper subject matter. For as the material of the carpenter is wood, and that of statuary bronze, so the subject matter of the art of living is each person's own life. Okay. Now, here we have a very interesting metaphor again. For as the material of the carpenter is wood, and the statuary, and that of statuary bronze. Do you recall the metaphors that we read also in Buddhist philosophy? Again, we have a very similar style of presentation, using metaphors from daily life to explain the meanings of the deeper philosophical meanings of what truth is or what reality is. Does everybody understand this quote? Or let's hear, what do you think this quote is saying? Somebody can just start with it.
Can you repeat that again, the quote?
Yeah, philosophy does not promise to secure anything external for man. Otherwise, it would be admitting something that lies beyond its proper subject matter. Let's take that line. What does it mean, beyond its proper subject matter? Any thoughts?
Ego?
Ego, or I would suggest being more literal with it, that perhaps he's saying that the practice of philosophy, in this case, the practice of securing wisdom in one's life, because that's what philosophy was in those days, is ring-fenced in a certain area that is the art of living, but has nothing to secure externally, such as wealth or health or position or status, because that is outside the actual art of living. We come back and reference the concept of what virtue is. Remember, virtue, harmony with nature, has no relationship to what's on the externals. The externals are only objective material for virtue or for us to act upon, and they can either be positive or negative depending on how we relate to them or how we interact with them. And so the second sentence, for as the material of the carpenter is wood, right? A carpenter works with wood. A statuary, which means building statues with bronze. So the subject matter of the art of living is each person's own life. Therefore, philosophy is the skill that allows us to actually work with the subject matter of our own life. Is that clear? And so it's a tool that we can use. The reason I wanted to put this quote in is because we'll see as we go further that Stoicism is very much a practical philosophy. And Epictetus himself, we're going to read a quote from him in a moment, was a very, very practical teacher. Okay, let's go on to point number three. Stoicism teaches the development of self-control and fortitude as a means of overcoming destructive emotions. Does that sound familiar?
Can you repeat it again, Arne?
Stoicism teaches the development of self-control and fortitude as a means of overcoming destructive emotions. Do you recall? It was almost exactly the same words that were used in the sutras of how we overcome discomfort. The philosophy holds that becoming a clear and unbiased thinker allows one to understand the universal reason, which is called logos, A primary aspect of Stoicism involves improving the individual's ethical and moral well-being. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
Do you recall how much we've talked about the very issue of ethics and moral, and how I've talked so much about mindfulness, mm-hmm. and how mindfulness often these days is taught without incorporating the ethical foundation? Mindfulness taught without the ethical foundation is just a tool. And as I often say, if one studies mindfulness efficiently, one can become a great sage and a great healer, as well as becoming a perfect assassin. The question is how one applies the skills that mindfulness gives us. And the Stoics speak precisely to the same practice, and they have specific practices that are parallels. So, virtue consists in a will that is in agreement with nature. The principle also applies to the realm of interpersonal relationships. To be free from anger, envy, and jealousy, and to accept even slaves as equals of other men, because all men alike are products of nature. That should be all people, not men. Okay? So again, we see a very interesting parallel. At the time of the Buddha, he was the only person to accept the untouchables, the equivalent to, or actually even lower than slaves in Indian society at the time. And throughout the history of Buddhist philosophy, there's been this egalitarianism. And this is very much a strong principle also in Stoic philosophy. Then number four, according to the Stoics, the senses constantly receive sensations, pulsations that pass from objects through the senses to the mind, where they leave an impression in the imagination, an impression arising from the mind that was called phantasma in Greek. So again, we see the relationship, the senses, the perception. Breathing in, I perceive the feelings. Breathing out, I perceive the feelings. Breathing in, I perceive the body. Breathing out, I perceive the body. Remember all that? Mm-hmm. So here we have a very, very close parallel again. Point number five, the mind has the ability to judge, approve, or reject an impression, enabling it to distinguish a true representation of reality from one that is false. And here is a very, very important principle of Stoic philosophy, that is, our mind, when it's trained, when we practice correctly, when we understand correctly, has the ability to see what's real and what's not real. Again, that's a direct parallel to the teachings we encountered already. And in following of Socrates' philosophy, this is point number six, the Stoics held that unhappiness and evil are the results of human ignorance, ignorance the source of unhappiness. Again, another parallel. If someone is unkind, it is because they are unaware of their own universal reason, which leads to the conclusion of unkindness. This could be published in any Buddhist philosophical book. Ignorance is the source of all ill will. And here we have, at the same time, the same developing thought from a different culture. Okay, number seven, philosophy for a Stoic is not just a set of beliefs or ethical claims. It is a way of life involving constant practice and training. Stoic philosophical and spiritual practices included logic, Socratic dialogue, self-dialogue, contemplation of death, mortality salience, training the attention to remain in the present moment, similar to mindfulness and some forms of Buddhist meditation, and daily reflections on everyday problems, and possible solutions with journaling. That would be writing. Philosophy for a Stoic is an active process of constant practice and self-reminder. Daily practices, the contemplation of death. Didn't we just go over mindfulness in the cemetery? How important, the key point of what the Buddha was teaching in mindfulness, one practicing it in the cemetery. So we see here again, parallel understanding of how to work. and how to function and what the tools are. This is very important that these are tools. These are not just things to be spoken of. Philosophy for the Greeks, for the Stoics, for sure, at this point in time, it was a practical skill to be applied in life. It wasn't something to be discussed over dinner and wine and then everybody go home to their normal lives and forget about the thoughts. It was something that had to be part of one's heartbeat every day. And we see this in Marcus Aurelius's comment in his Meditations, which if you've read a little bit about the history of Stoicism, you will see that Marcus Aurelius wrote a book called Meditations, and he was a great fan of Epictetus. And what he wrote was, every morning I wake up and I should be grateful that I'm alive, I haven't lost a leg, I'm not suffering. And every morning I wake up, I'm going to meet people who are not pleasant, who are not nice, who are going to try to take advantage of me. And every day I can be in control of what I experience. Daily practice.